Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, in Afghanistan, U.S. jets target a terrorist. They kill 9 children.
The little boys wear these little embroidered hats, and they had little rubber galoshes, and they were still all there, you know, ripped apart. Clearly, there were several pools of dried blood in the dust.
In Russia, political triumph for President Putin, and not a bad day for President Bush either. He signs the Medicare bill.
We show our concern for the dignity of our seniors by giving them quality health care. We show our respect for seniors by giving them more choices and more control over their decision-making.
These stories and Christmas classics salsa style, Hold the Reindeer, coming up Here and Now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Bush has signed landmark legislation to overhaul the Medicare system. The controversial $400 billion plan is the result of years of partisan debate and adds a prescription drug benefit for senior citizens. Mr. Bush says the changes will improve Medicare.
Medicare has spared millions of seniors from needless hardship. Each generation benefits from Medicare. Each generation has a duty to strengthen Medicare. And this generation is fulfilling our duty.
But Democratic lawmakers and some consumer groups say the legislation could undercut traditional Medicare coverage and will enrich drug companies at the expense of seniors. Opponents of the law have pledged to try to revise it next year. The White House is expressing concern about the fairness of Russia's parliamentary elections. The weekend voting gave Russian President Vladimir Putin's party control of parliament with a large plurality. NPR's Brian Naylor has more.
The White House said it shares the concerns of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The OSCE said the election was a step back from democratic reforms adopted in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. White House spokesman Scott McClellan told reporters the Bush administration hopes Russian lawmakers would now move forward on a reform agenda and support the U.S.-Russia partnership. The pro-presidential United Russia Party won more than 36% of the vote. All told, Putin is expected to command two-thirds of the Russian Duma. The Russian president is himself up for re-election next March, and his strong support in the Duma may make it possible to amend the Russian constitution, allowing him to run for a third term. Brian Naylor, NPR News, The White House.
Some school systems are closed in New England today following the severe storm over the weekend that dumped up to 4 feet of snow in some areas. The storm is being blamed for at least a dozen traffic deaths. Heather Claiborne of member station WNPR reports the accumulation in Hartford, Connecticut set a record.
December is a bit early in the season for a major nor'easter. Although accumulation totals varied from 6 to 20 inches across Connecticut, the weekend storm did bring enough snow to break a 40-year-old snowfall record for the date in the Hartford area. On Saturday, Bradley International Airport, the capital area's official weather reporting station, recorded 12.5 inches of snow. The old record for December 6th, 6.9 inches, was set back in 1964. Bradley was open during the storm, but had to call off dozens and dozens of flights. The airport's operations center says they've got a full rack of airplanes today, and things are improving. High schools are trying to reschedule 6 football championships that were postponed because of the storm. For NPR News, I'm Heather Claiborne in Hartford.
Wall Street, the Dow is up 35 points at 9,897, but the NASDAQ is down 4 at 1933. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, blue chip stocks are higher today, but technology shares are down a bit. Analysts say investors are marking time in advance of tomorrow's meeting of Federal Reserve policymakers on interest rates. The Fed is expected to leave rates unchanged, especially following last week's lackluster report on employment. The value of the dollar slid to record lows against the euro today. The Canadian government is considering a new proposal to end a bitter trade dispute over softwood lumber with the United States. The idea was floated over the weekend by administration officials and the U.S. lumber lobby. Dan Karpinchuk has the story.
Senior officials in Ottawa say the proposed deal could end the 2.5-year battle over softwood lumber. but they're also waiting to see what kind of reaction the proposal receives north of the border. If accepted, the agreement would replace U.S. duties on all Canadian softwood with a quota system that would set a ceiling on Canadian shipments to the U.S. It also lays out a plan for changes by Canadian provinces in how they subsidize the lumber industry. Those changes could eventually lead to free trade in lumber. But Washington would get to keep half of the $1.7 billion in duties it's collected so far. The deal would also last for 5 years and could be terminated by either government with 12 months' notice. But the Canadian government is not publicly ready to endorse the deal without first gauging the mood of the industry here, since other proposals over the past year have fallen through. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Airbus is proclaiming itself the world's leading supplier of commercial jets at an international aerospace exhibition in Dubai. An Airbus official said the company now controls 55% of the market versus 45% for Boeing. Boeing says its rival is boasting a little too quickly. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now, just days before an historic meeting to draft Afghanistan's first democratic constitution. Afghan officials say many ordinary citizens are more wary than ever of the U.S.-backed government of President Hamid Karzai. 9 children, all between the ages of 8 and 12, died in an air assault by 2 U.S. attack jets this weekend. The raid was meant to kill an alleged Taliban terrorist who'd allegedly bragged about killing foreign aid workers. Local people where the attack occurred said the terrorist was long gone by the time the jets came. Carlotta Gall covers Afghanistan for the New York Times and joins us on the line from Kabul. Thanks for talking to us, Carlotta.
My pleasure.
Carlotta, start by telling us what you know about the attack this weekend. We hear reports that this alleged Taliban operative who was targeted had left the area perhaps weeks earlier. Now, he was targeted apparently because he bragged about killing foreign aid workers. What's the status of that individual?
According to the villagers who openly admitted that he lived in that village and had been there recently for the Islamic festival of Eid just a few weeks ago, he left the village 2 weeks ago with his whole family, and they thought he'd gone to Pakistan. So I think he knew something was up. There had been a strike, an airstrike, in fact, in the area, in a field, 2 weeks before. And so they think he cleared out because he knew there was, you know, the heat was on. This is the villager's tale, but it was pretty convincing.
Are the Americans continuing to insist that he was there?
No, that today they're conceding that maybe he wasn't killed. You see, along with the 9 children, one man was killed. And at first, I think the Americans thought they'd got their man. Now that they say they're trying to identify that man, the villagers, meanwhile, have buried him. And I met the mother of the dead man, and she said he was a 25-year-old who'd just returned from Iran for his wedding. He'd only been back in the village for 10 days, and he'd been abroad in Iran working for 3 years. So a very different picture of a young man just coming back to get married and busy helping around the house.
Carlotta, can you paint us a picture of what you saw in this village?
Well, it was desperately sad because we arrived Sunday afternoon, a good more than 24 hours after it had happened. And the villagers took us to the place where the children were killed, and it's right in the center of the village. And their embroidered hats, you know, the little boys wear these little embroidered hats, and they had little rubber galoshes, and they were still all there, you know, bearing the shrapnel marks, you know, ripped apart and lying in the dust. And clearly there were several pools of blood, dried blood in the dust. And tiny little shoes. Some of the children were obviously very young. And then they'd been playing marbles, so they showed us the glass marbles that were still there on the floor. And then two of the little girls were collecting water just nearby at the stream, and they were also killed. So it was desperately sad to see the families and such small children. And I think this is why it touched a real nerve in Afghanistan, because, you know, they love children. And there have been mistakes before in U.S. airstrikes and operations, but this one has, you know, caused the president to express his profound shock. And right across the country, I think people are feeling it.
What is your sense of why the United States would not send in a team, a small commando team? There are lots of U.S. special forces in Afghanistan. Why not send in a team to do something about this alleged Taliban killer instead of coming in with an airstrike?
Yeah, this is a question which they never quite answer. They have tried to do that more over the last year. They certainly don't use big bombs to flatten a house anymore. But clearly it was using the wrong type of weapon to catch one man. They were monitoring this place. They maybe had satellite imagery. They thought he was in the vicinity. But if you ever attack a village or even a hillside in Afghanistan, there's always going to be some kid or some shepherd or some farmer around, you know. So it seems a very blunt instrument. And I think it might be a lack of resources. You know, they don't have so many troops here. They only have 11,500 troops fighting the Taliban here. You know, nothing like the amount in Iraq. Or possibly they're worried about casualties. It is difficult to go into a hostile place and find your man. Much easier to send a few rockets or, you know, incendiary bombs from a plane. So I think it's a mixture of all that.
Carlotta, just to finish up, what will be the impact on support among Afghans for the government of Hamid Karzai?
Well, the villagers, you know, despite their grief, said, listen, we don't support Taliban, we support this government. A father who'd lost a boy told me that. But I think inevitably it makes them hostile to foreign troops on their land. They just see them coming and shooting up the place and not doing any good. And so I think it will increase a lot of hostility to the foreign people here, not just the military, but the people trying to work as aid workers and so on. And I think it does play into the hands of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, who are still paying people to go and, you know, launch attacks against the foreigners and against the government. So I think it will play into the hands of the wrong people and make it more difficult for the government to convince the people that this is the right path.
Carlotta Gall covers Afghanistan for the New York Times. She joined us from Kabul. Thanks so much, Carlotta.
Thank you.
A landslide for one political party in Russia this weekend. The United Russia Party was really a triumph for one man, President Vladimir Putin. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, no party's won anywhere close to the 37% of parliament United Russia won. And arguably, no leader's ever had as much support and power as Putin. But the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, today said the election was a step backward on the road to democracy in Russia. Richard Chambers is the chief advisor for the OSCE's observer mission for the elections. And here's what he said from Moscow.
We are seeing less competition between political parties. We are seeing unfair competition to the benefit of one party that is supported by the state. We are seeing unfair media coverage, particularly because there was clear bias being shown towards one party, and that's the party of United Russia. They were overwhelmingly positively portrayed in the media, whilst their opponents were very negatively portrayed.
Well, joining us now from Moscow is Scott Peterson, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Hi, Scott.
Thank you.
Hey, Scott, before we get into what the results of this election mean for Russians, you've just heard that the OSCE has questioned the fairness of the election campaign. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that they're right in the sense that the cards were definitely stacked against opposition candidates early on in the campaign process. In other words, we didn't see much in the way of technical difficulties yesterday during the actual voting. And in fact, most of the Russians who I spoke to in polling stations were very, very serious and solemn about exercising their democratic rights yesterday. They were taking it seriously and convinced that their vote actually meant something. But, of course, what critics are saying, and we did see ample evidence of this, was that that the Kremlin ensured that there was a one single message that was going out before the vote. It very much impacted the way people were thinking. And there were also other strategies that were used by the Kremlin and by pro-presidential candidates to basically force opponents out of races, get them either tied up in the courts or get them into tangles with local election commissions. And these were methods basically that were used to make sure that that the right result ended up. So it wasn't a question of stealing ballots, but it was definitely a question of stacking the cards in your favor.
Yeah. Well, in any event, United Russia, that political party, won big, but also two nationalist parties, also strong supporters of the Kremlin, combined to take a strong second place at nearly 21% of the vote. A president and nationalist tied in Russia, Scott, what's the impact of that?
Well, I think that it's still unclear, in fact, what the impact is going to be. I mean, what was remarkable was that in elections past, there were kind of gains made by liberal parties and by liberal candidates, and people thought that this might be the beginning of a proper kind of a civil society in Russia. And here we're seeing, in fact, a kind of a surge, you know, people basically responding to this nationalist message, this message that Russia, again, can be strong, hearkening back to some of the better points that people remember about the Soviet past, where they were, a superpower rivaled only by the United States. And in some cases, they even make references back to Russia's pre-Bolshevik, times of monarchy, where Russia also was an imperial power, very big, very powerful, very listened to.
Now, as for that Soviet past, Scott, the communists won just 12.7% of the vote. That's half their total in 1999. Communism, once and for all, just a spent force in Russia.
Well, I wouldn't say that it's a spent force in Russia, but of course the Communist Party that we have in Russia today is nothing like the one that ruled the Soviet period. I mean, they are ones that have always looked back and appealed to people's nostalgia for how great the Soviet Union was.
But now the nationalists have co-opted that, haven't they? That sense of nostalgia for a powerful Russia.
Well, that is right. And in fact, what you find is that some of the most important slogans used by the communists in order to gain support in the past have been co-opted not just by nationalist parties, but they've also even been co-opted by United Russia in terms of, united we can be strong together, about a central power, a central authority. And of course, the communists haven't been especially effective as an opposition over the last few years either. And what we found in the voting yesterday and the results as they're coming out today is that Russians really do like to back a winner. I mean, you find that around the world, and Russians are no different. And, they see that this administration at least appears to have its act together and appears to be an administration of action. People feel that, and they're certainly younger than many of their predecessors, and so they are, in that sense, have all the things moving in their direction.
Scott, just to finish up, what about liberalism? There are still voices calling for market reform, democratic reform in Russia. Are they still being heard at all? Did they measure on any Richter scales at all in this parliamentary election?
Well, no, I think one of the most surprising things is that those groups, too, have been completely weakened by the election that we saw yesterday. And, of course, part of that is because a lot of these parties, instead of actually standing for anything in terms of ideology, and that goes for every single one, from United Russia all the way down through the liberal parties and others, they really don't have a platform beyond the personalities that are leading them. So people who are yearning after kind of reforms in Russia, I mean, some people have just given up on that kind of thing, which I think is one of the most startling things from this election. They've given up on the possibility of worthwhile reforms, and they appear to be wanting instead to go with a party that already has shown that it can rule, at least that it can hold its ground in a lot of ways on the world stage, and they think that that's good enough for them.
Scott Peterson is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Moscow. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, political devils in the details as President Bush signs the Medicare bill into law. And later in the show, our Latin music maestro Jose Maso on how Latin America turns Christmas into one huge dance party. Forget sleigh bells. Salsa, anyone? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Surrounded by seniors in Washington this morning, President Bush signed into law the most sweeping changes in the history of the Medicare program.
We kept our promise and found a way to get the job done. This legislation is the achievement of members in both political parties. And this legislation is a victory for all of America's seniors.
Well, a Republican president signing a Medicare bill with drug coverage. The conventional political wisdom goes that's a masterstroke, an end run that takes a usually Democratic issue, health care for seniors, right off the table. But is it politically really as simple as that? Well, to discuss that and Hillary and the war and, oh, John Kerry and the F word. Joining us on the line are two of our regular D.C. roundtable members. Andrea Stone covers Congress for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Bill.
And Bill Douglas covers the White House for Knight Ridder.
Hi.
Well, Andrea, to start with you, people are learning more about what's in this Medicare reform bill, I think. Besides adding that famous or infamous prescription drug benefit, what have you been finding out about some of the devils in the details?
Well, there are a lot of details. This thing is over 600 pages long. And one of the things that the seniors might be surprised to learn is that they're not going to be able to buy Medigap to cover some of the out-of-pocket costs they will still have under this drug benefit. It is prohibited in this new law that they'll be able to do that. Another thing is there's a lot of uncertainty. Most of the drug benefit doesn't kick in until 2006. It's uncertain whether there will be in your city or in your region that there will be private plans that will actually offer coverage. It's not clear what it's going to cost. And the thing is just so complex. I mean, it's hard for a young person to understand. And I'm not sure that somebody in their 70s or 80s can really get through the details here.
You know, Bill, I took an informal poll around the radio station this morning. And this is a place where people read about this stuff and are even fairly obsessed with it. And I said, does anybody understand how the privatization in several cities in 2010 works? Not a single person understood it. Is there possibly a problem for President Bush down the months, down the years, when people start to look at this thing and say either they don't get it or they don't like it?
Maybe years, not in weeks, and maybe not even months. I mean, it largely depends on what the Democrats do on the campaign trail. For the most part, the Bush administration and the people in the White House and the Bush campaign are very good and very adept at making things plain. I mean, what you've got here is you've got, as you said earlier, a Republican president signing a Medicare bill and basically stealing an issue away from the Democrats. And that's how it's going to play out. And, I mean, you won't have a banner saying mission accomplished in the background, but what you're going to have is the White House and the Republican Party delivering a message, promises made, promises kept.
Well, Andrea, do you agree with Bill that this is essentially, no matter how you cut it, in the near term, and I'm talking about, you know, less than a year from now when there's a presidential election, in the near term, this is just a winner for President Bush?
Well, I think so. But, today there's also going to be a demonstration, we'll see how big, on Capitol Hill, that the Democrats are going to have seniors coming out to protest this. And, you know, the Democrats have a real challenge here. They've got to tell them, look, it sounds good on the outside, a prescription drug plan, but look at the details. It's not that good. You know, it's interesting because AARP, whose endorsement of this bill was really key to getting the votes to pass it, is now this week, started last week, is coming out with sort of a counter a PR campaign, if you will, to say, hey, you know, we did the right thing supporting it, but if you didn't agree with us on this, we're still in your court on fighting privatization of Social Security, and we're going to keep fighting to make it legal to import cheaper drugs from Canada. And on a whole host of issues, we're still the old AARP. So they obviously are feeling a little heat. They lost 15,000 seniors resigned their membership since this bill came out and since AARP signed on to it. They obviously are concerned.
Well, let's turn to another political issue, if you can call it an issue. Bill, the presidential campaign of John Kerry, he's refusing to apologize for using the F word to describe President Bush's Iraq policy. He did that in an interview with Rolling Stone magazine. What's the impact of all this on Kerry's seemingly faltering campaign?
It's an interesting move by Kerry. I mean, he's a smart man, and he doesn't use words out of his hat. One could suggest that maybe the word was used to tap into that angry Dean base.
Yeah.
And it was Rolling Stone, after all.
And it was Rolling Stone.
Right. Yeah. You know, you have to remember that a year ago he was the front runner, or the presumed, and now he just can't get any traction on anything. He is just running way behind. People are talking about him as the first one who will, who will drop out of the campaign. He's got that sort of, Mount Rushmore kind of look on his face.
Yeah.
That kind of hangdog, long face, and a very serious guy.
But, Bill, he's not a hangdog guy, right?
No, he's got some regular guy in him. I play hockey with him every now and then in Washington, D.C., and, you know, he can use some locker room words. I mean, he's got the sense of humor, and he might be running into a little bit of what Al Gore ran into in 2000. I mean, Al Gore had a fixed public persona, you know, stiff, wooden, humorless. But once you got exposed to one for any length of time, you found the opposite was just true. But he seemed to feel compelled to put on that public face.
Yeah. Speaking of public faces, Hillary Clinton, on the Sunday TV shows, she was on a couple of them, she took a harder line on going to war in Iraq than most of the Democratic candidates. She said, however flawed the intelligence may have been, Saddam Hussein was certainly trying to get weapons of mass destruction, and that was a casus belli. What she complained about was the handling of the post-war phase. What's Hillary up to? Andrea?
Well, she was over in Afghanistan and Iraq over Thanksgiving. I think part of it is she's really trying to give herself some credentials on the foreign policy defense side of the ledger for, a run for the presidency. Maybe not next year, which she denied again on Meet the Press. But, everybody thinks in 2008 she's going to be, that's assuming, of course, that President Bush is reelected, that she will be the candidate.
Thanks very much to both of you. Bill Douglas covers the White House for Knight Ridder. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
And Andrea Stone covers Congress for USA Today. Thanks a lot, Andrea.
Thank you, Bill.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. We'll be right back.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Coming up, scientists at the National Institutes of Health may be getting too close to the private sector. A 7-year-old boy in Louisiana is punished for talking about his parents to a schoolmate. The boy has two moms. And Latin music at Christmas time. You can still dance to it.
The music styles would change as far as what you would hear on the radio or what you would hear at home or what would be performed live. It would go from the dance music of the urban sounds to the mountain music, what we call música campesina or de la montaña or jíbara.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. President Bush today signed into law the most far-reaching changes in Medicare since the program started 40 years ago. The controversial $400 billion overhaul adds prescription drug benefits to the National Health Insurance Program for the elderly. The radical reforms also allow the elderly to break out of their federal coverage and use private insurance. Critics say the reforms are too expensive and will not work. The U.S. Supreme Court will not rule in a major age discrimination case. The justices refused to hear a lawsuit filed by a former employee of Electronic Data Systems who claimed the company targeted older workers for layoffs. Another U.S. soldier was killed in an attack in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul today. U.S. officials say a soldier from the 101st Airborne was killed outside a gas station in an apparent drive-by shooting. Just yesterday, a soldier from the same division was killed, two others wounded in a roadside bomb attack. The U.S. military is getting ready to move some of its bases in Europe. Today, Pentagon officials are briefing NATO on plans to reassign troops from Germany to global hotspots in the Middle East and Central Asia. The German bases were a pivotal part of U.S. Cold War strategy. A sweeping victory for Russian President Vladimir Putin in parliamentary elections is under fire from human rights officials. The pro-Putin United Russia Party won 37% of the vote, giving it a clear edge over its rivals. International observers say the vote was free but not fair, with taxpayer money and state television used to support some parties but not others. The Northeast is coping with the fallout of a weekend snowstorm that has been linked to 13 deaths. Many schools are closed. Boston's Logan Airport is trying to clear a backlog of travelers unable to get out of town over the weekend. National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Hayes says the deepest snow was nearly 4 feet at Mount Washington in New Hampshire.
Being in Maine and New Hampshire, that much snow this time of year is not as unusual as it is in other parts of the country. However, we did have a lot of our longtime residents in portions of the mountains of Maine and New Hampshire tell us this is the most snow they've seen in many years. So this is an unusual storm for any time during the winter.
Amtrak also has delays out of Boston because its equipment is buried in snowdrifts. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are narrowly mixed. The Dow is up 35 points at 98.98. The Nasdaq and S&P are down.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. No institution supposed to be more objective, above the political and economic fray, than the National Institutes of Health, because decisions made there can be a matter of life and death. But could top scientists at the NIH have increasingly clouded vision because they're receiving unprecedented fees and stock options from drug and biomedical companies? That's a question posed in an article in yesterday's Los Angeles Times. On the line from Washington, D.C. is reporter David Willman. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
David, as you report, scientists getting paid for outside consulting is perfectly legal, but there are new ethical guidelines, right? How does that work?
Well, it used to be at the National Institutes of Health that institute directors could not accept fees and or stock options, compensation of this nature, from drug development companies. But in November of 1995, then NIH Director Harold Varmus issued a memo to his institute directors and his top office staff saying that effective immediately, those institute directors could accept that compensation.
NIH officials rely on an honor system that an employee will pledge not to participate in decisions affecting an outside client. Is that effective?
We documented a number of instances where commitments that were made up front weren't complied with, and the people who were involved with that said that it was always unintentional. Hmm. One example is the fellow who used to be the top diabetes researcher within the National Institutes of Health signed a quote-unquote recusal pledging not to take actions affecting his company client, which at the time was Park Davis Warner Lambert. At the time, he was helping to oversee and supervise a nationwide clinical trial for diabetes prevention using a drug made by that company. Mm. He wrote a letter on November 6, 1997, to the Food and Drug Administration, which had questioned the advisability of that drug being used in the clinical trial because of evidence of liver toxicity. And the official's letter to the FDA said NIH thought that the drug was plenty safe enough. And then it turned out that 6 months later in that same clinical trial, a woman named Audrey LaRue Jones fell into sudden liver failure and died.
Hmm. David, what can the public do if they want to find out what scientists at the NIH are being paid and who they're being paid by?
First of all, I suppose they could read the articles that we had in yesterday's paper.
Yeah.
One of the things that we pointed out, however, is that the degree of openness has shrunk quite a bit. In the 5 years that I've been trying to gather these financial disclosure records, there's been a dramatic reduction of disclosure.
Is the problem here that they could possibly skew some of their decisions, for example, to use a certain drug that they're being paid by a company to promote or not?
We, in this, again, in yesterday's report, had posed four rhetorical questions that I think really get to the heart of what you're talking about, Bill. Will judgment calls on the safety of individual patients be affected by commercial interests? Can study participants trust that experimental treatments are chosen on merit and not because of officials' personal financial interests? Will scientists shade their interpretations of study results to favor their clients? Will officials favor their clients over other companies that seek NIH grants or research collaborations?
Yeah. And just to be crystal clear, David, in this very thorough investigative report, there's no implication that lives are being put at risk, or is there?
Well, I think if you talk to the family of Audrey LaRue Jones, they would tell you that, yes, lives are very much put at risk. We're only seeing, I think, little small landmarks here where we can see that, you know, direct harm on people. But you're talking about decisions that are made every day. Now, the people involved are going to say that even though they're getting paid by companies, it does not influence their judgments. I'll leave it to your listeners to decide whether or not that's always the case.
David Willman is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. David Willman, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Well, a school board in Lafayette, Louisiana, is planning to meet this Thursday concerning a 7-year-old second grader who was punished for telling a friend he had two mothers, that his moms were gay. And he informed his friend that what that meant was when a girl likes a girl. Joe Cook, head of the Louisiana American Civil Liberties Union, said they're now ready to file a lawsuit if the school doesn't issue an apology to the student and his parents. Joe joins us on the line. Joe, how was the child punished, and how did the ACLU get involved in all this?
Well, this child was scolded in front of his classmates. She told him he should never say it at school and sent him to the principal's office instead of letting him go to recess. And then she required him to attend a special behavioral clinic at 6:45 in the morning, where he was allegedly forced to repeat right, and I will never use the word gay in school again. And, you know, our position in this is that to tell a 7-year-old boy that he can't talk about his family not only makes the child feel confused and hurt, it violates his constitutional right to free speech and equal treatment.
Yeah, well, Joe, the head of the Lafayette Parish school system, James Easton, has released a statement saying the discipline addressed ordinary disturbances in an appropriate manner and goes on to say the student was not belittled or embarrassed. Now, that doesn't sound like much of an apology. What are you asking for beyond that?
To go to the heart of the thing, the apology would be, I think, appropriate. As far as a constitutional issue, what we want is that the school remove all mentions of the incident and clear his disciplinary record, and that they refrain from restricting his speech in the future. And I think that this points up the problem that is all across the country. It's all across Louisiana, and that's children of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered families are subject to harassment and bullying and sometimes even physical attack because of who they are, who their parents are. And we tried to get a Safe Schools Act passed, and we had it sponsored by Senator Irons and Representative Richmond. And had that important legislation passed, this 7-year-old might have been spared this unnecessary disciplinary action and its consequent humiliation.
What's the reaction been in Lafayette, Louisiana, to this?
It's been overwhelmingly positive in support of the child and his mom. In this case, they think the school district made a mistake, and that what we've asked for is very reasonable.
Joe, what about the boy and his moms? How are they doing?
They are coping with the situation. I think doing extraordinarily well under the circumstances, and they've been a good ambassador for getting the word out and telling this story. They did not ask to be put in the limelight here. It came about because of the bad conduct on the part of the school. The child, it wasn't the child's conduct that caused this. And obviously, we've got a long way to go to educate the educators about dealing positively and appropriately with alternative lifestyles, non-traditional families in this state, in that school district.
Joe Cook is the head of the Louisiana ACLU. Joe, thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Still to come, Jose Masso joins us to discuss his spicy Christmas favorites from the Latin music world. You're listening to Here and Now. Seems like a long time now that conservatives like Rush Limbaugh, to name just one, have dominated the radio talk show circuit. But now a company is hoping to give a lot more airtime to a whole other point of view by creating a liberal radio talk show network. Mark Walsh is CEO of Progressive Media. Mark, we're calling it a network. Is it a network yet, or is it kind of an idea?
Well, we have hired some talent. So when I say network, I guess, yeah, we're still in chapter one of being a network. Mm-hmm. But our goal is by early spring of 2004 to have a 14 to 18-hour broadcast day of live programming, most of it talk slash news with a real comedic tilt. One of our first employees hired was Liz Winstead, who was the original producer, founding producer of The Daily Show, now with Jon Stewart. Uh-huh. So that sense of comedic, a wry smile, a tilt of the eyebrow, and aggressive slant on both Democrats and Republicans, whoever's making the least sense on a given day, I guess, is one of the goals. And that 14 to 18 hours will be broadcast over the five to seven stations that we have teed up to purchase in major cities.
Now, you're going to purchase stations. It's not like a station that already exists will change its format.
No, it is a station that already exists that we will buy and change its format.
Okay.
And we will put the 14 to 18 hours on it.
Mark, has something changed from the left? Liberal talk show hosts have been tried before. They don't have a great track record either on radio or in TV. Then Al Franken, for example, comes along, and he's got information in his book. It's well-researched, but he's also very funny. Is there some sort of a shift out there? Are liberals getting funnier? And why is that important?
Well, no disrespect to the names I'm about to mention, because I think they were set up for failure, but the Mario Cuomo and Alan Dershowitz and Robert Reich and Jim Hightowers of the world had shows that were extremely pithy and informative, but they often were 2 hours sandwiched in between a vast wasteland of right-wing conservative talk shows. So as you know, in radio, formatic purity, or the ability of the listener to know there's a home on their dial or the button on the dashboard, so to speak, is always going to be sports talk. It's always going to be acid rock. It's always going to be easy listening or conservative talk or whatever. These shows, sometimes weekly, sometimes daily, were sort of adrift in a larger, jarring and competitive, or I should say a non-sequential or non-rational environment that they found themselves in, sort of point number one. Point number two, to your question, I'd like to think we're getting a little bit funnier. I think what we're trying to do, all of us in the liberal side, is try and poke fun at ourselves a little more to show the foibles of both ourselves and most assuredly the foibles of the other side. And I think lastly, and perhaps most importantly, America is divided like no other time that I can remember as an adult, and I think a lot of research shows this. And in division, there is media opportunity, is our conclusion, that many on the liberal side, or the progressive side of the world, do feel very upset by what's happening here, do feel disenfranchised by the policies of this president, do feel that there's things going on that they have deep, dramatic rejection of. And that division, which is so obvious when you look at the polls on the approval ratings of this president or other leaders that he has surrounded himself with, shows in our mind that there's an audience out there waiting to hear some news about this division. And we think that's a real opportunity.
Mark Walsh is the CEO of Progress Media, trying to start up a liberal radio network and down the road a bit with it. Mark, thanks very much.
Great to be here.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Well, music's, of course, a huge part of the holiday season. Classics return every year. Bing Crosby, Perry Como, Nat King Cole, Johnny Mathis, even Elvis, and even the Chipmunks. And in recent years, you can add another name, Jose Feliciano. His Feliz Navidad's become a new standard, heard piped into the speaker systems of shopping malls from coast to coast and all over Latin America.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. Feliz Navidad.
But in the Spanish-speaking world, of course, there's much more Christmas music than just Jose Feliciano, and in particular, in the past 30 years, two salsa CDs have become seasonal classics. They are Willie Colón's 1972 recording, Asalto Navideño, and El Gran Combo de Puerto Rico's 1985 recording, Nuestra Música. Here and Now's Latin music lover, Jose Maso, is here to ring our bells, Jose. Joining me in the studio, Jose Maso. Hi, Jose.
Bill, my pleasure to be here.
You know, Jose, somehow in much of North America, you tend to think of quieter music, Silent Night and all that, when you think of Christmas music. Not salsa. What's going on here?
Well, that's true, although from time to time I go to sleep singing Jingle Bell, Jingle Bell, Jingle Bell. So it's not always Silent Night. But having said that, you know, the interesting thing is, in my experience as a Puerto Rican, being raised in Puerto Rico and then coming to the United States, was growing up knowing that during the months of December into January, the music styles would change as far as what you would hear on the radio or what you would hear at home or what would be performed live. It would go from the dance music of the urban sounds to the mountain music, what we call música campesina or de la montaña or jíbara. And that would always happen. But then all of a sudden, 1972, Puerto Ricans in the United States, for the most part, young Puerto Ricans, they were going through that rediscovery of their roots.
Right.
You know, the Black Power movement had happened in the United States. The Young Lords were happening. And young Puerto Ricans such as Willie Colon, who at the time was 22 years old, says, wow, I'd like to do a CD or recording, because that was not a CD back then, of Christmas music. But I want to do it my own style. I want to pay tribute to Puerto Rico. I want to bring a guitar player who knows how to play that style of campesino music, montaña music, that's Yo Motón on the Cuatro, and then I'm going to give it that New York trombone, heavy urban sound, and the result was Asalto Navideño.
De tierra lejana. He comes up with an album called Christmas Assault. Mm-hmm. What's that about?
Well, there's a tradition, unlike here, going back to the caroling, where we go house to house, uh-huh. and we sing, and there's a group of people, and isn't that nice? In our country, and in many of the Latin American countries, you'll be sleeping in the middle of the night. It's midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. All of a sudden, the number of cars are showing up. You hear, you know, the dogs barking, and then somebody's outside of your house starting to play all this music, and you can't turn them away. You've got to let them in. So it's called a Christmas assault. Basically, they've come and assaulted your sleep, and now you've got to let them in, and they're going to stay until all the food and drink is gone, and then they go on to the next house, and they keep on going what's called a parranda, and it goes on to the wee hours in the morning.
Fantastic.
So this is basically an asalto navideño. And, Bill, the one cut I want to start off with, which is the one that really grabs you because it speaks about the nostalgia to Puerto Rico, and it mixes those three styles right away of the mountain music, the guitar, the trombone sound, and the singing of Hector Lavoe. This one is a tribute to Puerto Rico titled Canto a Borinque.
Borinque te quiero porque en ti nací y en ti fue que vi resplandor primero. Yo te soy sincero, una inardecida será aunque en ti moriré, pero yo te cantaré desde la otra vida, pero yo te cantaré borinquen desde la otra vida.
You know, something that sweet and beautiful, even if you were getting kicked out of bed in the middle of Christmas night, it couldn't be in that bad a mood.
No. And what really made this, I remember I was back home in Puerto Rico for Christmas holidays from college, from here in the United States, and I was walking the streets of Old San Juan, and from a jukebox in the far, I heard this sound, and I went, who is that? And then I went to the jukebox, you know, to find out. I said, Willie Colon? What? What's Willie Colon doing? But just to hear that, I mean, it's really patriotic. It's the time of the year where all of us, regardless if we're from the Dominican Republic, Colombia, Mexico, Puerto Rico, we really have a nostalgia to go back home.
What else you got from this Willie Colon Christmas album?
Well, I mentioned the fact that it's a combination of the campesina music. And this next selection titled Traigo la Salsa, he really, right up front, lets us know that he's including, and it's sort of like telling the salseros, listen, this is salsa, and I'm bringing you salsa, but I'm going to include the sounds of Puerto Rico, and I'm going to include the cuatro guitar featuring Yomo Toro. This one's titled Traigo la Salsa. Let us wind up this section with Willie Colon. Listen to the trombone in this, and listen to Hector Lavoe, and listen to the power of this selection, which for many of us brought us not only back home to Puerto Rico, but opened our world to other parts of Latin America, because this one is titled La Murga de Panama.
Some of the music on this Willie Colon album is not necessarily specifically Christmas music. It was on this Christmas album and has become associated with
yes,
Christmas.
Exactly.
El Gran Combo de Puerto Rico,
Tell us about that album.
This particular group had recorded a few recordings. I always say CD, but you and I are a little bit older, so we have to remember this was on vinyl first. They recorded a few albums.
Vinyl? What was that? Oh, yeah.
In the 1960s and 70s that included some Christmas music. But it wasn't until this particular album came out that they really hit it on the nose. And this was recorded in 1985. It's entitled Nuestra Música, Our Music. And again, it pays tribute to Puerto Rican music. But interesting enough, not all the songs speak specifically to the holidays or Christmas, but it speaks about the ambiance, the partying, the what goes on during that time period. And no better way than starting this off with Jerry Rivas on vocals talking about a party called La Fiesta de Pilito.
El año pasado tuvimos problemas, quizás este año tengamos más. Si el año pasado tuvimos problemas, quizás este año tengamos más. Pero no se apuren que la Navidad a la vuelta de la esquina está. Pero no se apuren que la Navidad a la vuelta de la esquina está.
Vamos pa' aquí, vamos pa' allá.
Maybe we should finish where we started. We talked about Asalto Navideño, Christmas Assault. There's a tune on this album which is called just that.
Asalto Navideño, a gran combo of Puerto Rico under the direction of Rafael Itiel, just celebrated about 41 years of being together. They won their first Grammy Award finally for their anniversary album that was recorded last year. This one's titled Asalto Navideño from the compact disc Nuestra Música. Salto Navideño, Bill, get on your dancing shoes, join us, get ready to eat, drink, and be merry because we are going to have a good time with these two classical CDs, Willie Colon, Héctor Lavoe, Yo Motoro, Asalto Navideño, El Gran Combo, Nuestra Música.
And Jose Maslow, you know it's coming. Feliz Navidad.
Thank you.
A usted. Thanks so much for joining us, Jose. Here in Now's Latin music lover, Jose Maslow, is the host of Con Salsa on WBUR in Boston. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. Join me next time for the news and these stories here and now. The UN holds a summit on technology haves and have-nots and the Internet. And well beyond 'twas the night before, 'tis the season for poems about the holidays. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.